Okay, thank you. And I would like to thank the organizers of both programs for the possibility of participating in them, and also possibility of speaking about some work we did on systems out of equilibrium. And I thought that would be interesting after having, I think 2 weeks ago, a focus on this subject. And still, so I will refer to many things which we already have seen, and we'll concentrate mostly on what that could be interesting on the fermionic side. And so for systems out of equilibrium, we could imagine different situations. What is very much discussed nowadays is what happens with in quantum quenches, that is when we prepare the system in some state and let it evolve with some Hamiltonian. What is less discussed is what happens with a free expansion, not in a free space, but in a lattice, because there are certain constraints, the spectrum is bounded, and so that could lead to specific effects. Of course, during correlated system, we have heard 2 weeks ago something, some things about how the drive close to a empirical point could be characterized by universal quantities, and mainly in transport, one subject which is interesting is how one has a steady state with a bias, let's say, in electric field or a bias in temperature. One reaches a steady state, and how this state out of equilibrium looks like. In this talk, I will concentrate on these first two topics. And for them, the motivation is, of course, coming from quantum gases. I'm going to show you two pictures, which you have already seen many, many times, at least those who are a long time here, which is the one, the experiment by Emanuel Bloch in his group when he was at Munich still. And it consists of putting a BSC on an optical lattice, which is shallow. So in principle, one has a BSC with some features which correspond to the lattice. For example, if this is the image after time of light evolution, then what happens is that one sees the k equals zero peak for characterizing the Bose-Einstein condensate. And due to the lattice, then there are some other Bragg peaks. But then, I don't think, in that paper, I don't think, but maybe.
Because I once had this experience.
Oh, really?
In theory.
I think I gave this talk in front of him once, and he did not protest.
But, check it.
Okay, I check it again. Okay. Right, the other one, which is the one, I think what is, January 5th or so, 2002, there is Tilman Esslinger is on there. But there, I check it. And then at t equals zero, the lattice is made very deep. And in that lattice, the ground state would be a Mott insulator. And so at t equals zero, one has this situation. But then these pictures are taken as time evolves, so to say. And what one sees is that the feature appears, which is characteristic of a Mott insulator, where one doesn't see any coherence. But as time passes by, coherence is recovered. So, and this can be understood easily in thinking that a good representation of this system is a Bose-Haber model. And if we go to the limit of very strong interactions, let us forget about this term, and then the evolution of the initial state is just governed by something, which is by a Hamiltonian which has eigenvalues which are integer numbers times u. Which means that essentially there is a period which will be 1 over u, where we should essentially recover the initial state. And in fact, what here is the picture here is showing the intensity at this peak as a function of time. One sees that these are collapse and revivals, and of course there is a overall relaxation. That's one picture. Then the other subject is,
Could you remind us what was the main reason of relaxation?
The relaxation, this is an interacting system. And of course, this is not the pure Hamiltonian. I mean, the real Hamiltonian has this part.
about the external potential. Can be something due to the external potential.
So the external potential. I'm certainly not considering here, for example, the confining potential. So this explanation is, if you want it, the simplest. And however, certainly all those terms will contribute to relaxation. Yes.
So actually, they have a recent paper, and there are two things. There are some extra features, which is like higher bounds.
Okay.
Not discussed there.
Which are not discussed here.
Some defacing, and also external potential, definitely, that you have different densities. Right. Even if t is equal to zero, those two would lead to defacing.
Sorry, what did you say the period was? Did you say 1/u?
Essentially, it should be the period 1/u, yeah. I will show you some numerical results where you can see it directly that is one of the interaction when the interaction is strong.
So, but you said tunneling is nothing?
Tunneling is zero. Yeah, they can really.
Okay, let me come to the other picture, which is well known, which was presented by David Weiss, I think, 3 weeks ago or so when he was here. And this is what is called his, he called it his quantum Newton cradle. Okay, and essentially one has here a one-dimensional system of bosons, interacting bosons, and at t equals zero, momentum is given to the cloud, so you can imagine the cloud being shifted in two, and then it begins to oscillate, and when it oscillates, it comes back, they collide, and here there are the pictures of the position. And well, after having a number of these collisions, one can look at the momentum distribution function, which are here for three different strength of interaction. This is weakly interacting, more strong, and even strongly interacting. And well, these the results they obtain are certainly not what one would expect in a thermal system, although this is an interacting system. And of course, one could, one has to remember that this in a one-dimensional system, the interacting bosons in continuous space with a just contact interaction are the Liebig-Linacker model, which is an integrable one. And then one can suspect that because of that, the system will not relax to something which is thermal. However, the system has here a periodic a harmonic potential, or let me say a trapping potential, which has also anharmonic terms. So in fact, how much this affects the system is a question, but experiments show that it doesn't seem to be affected by that. So how one reaches thermalization is a question here. And now, with this kind of motivation, I would like to pass to systems which are essentially showing these kinds of effects, but on the fermionic side. And so for that, we use numerical methods. And the numerical method will be the time-dependent density matrix normalization group, which was introduced by Steve White and the group by Uli Sholok some 6 years ago. And well, here one could have two versions of it. Let us say if one has a Hamiltonian which has only nearest neighbor interaction, then if we look at the time evolution in a small time step, delta t, we could separate the Hamiltonian in a path which we could call even, where I is even, or which is odd, where I is odd. And of course, we can separate them, but we make an error, which is about the delta t squared. So we should make delta t very small. But this kind of separation fits very well to the scheme of density matrix renormalization group, where one has one part of the system, one part of the whole thing, which is the system, one part which we could call the environment. One calculates the density matrix and traces out the environment such that one has the reduced density matrix for the system. And this is done in this situation, but now we take out two sides and we translate through the system, always improving on these two sides. And since these parts here are exactly corresponding to two sides, we would have the time evolution exactly on that path. However, things become more complicated if we have Hamiltonians which have an interaction which is of longer range. And for us, it will be interesting to look at such Hamiltonians at some point. So in order to deal with such a situation, there is another possibility, which is one starts with a wave function, and again one has an evolution in small delta t. And now one can make an approximation for the Hamiltonian, which is the one which is made by people doing exact diagonalizations with Lanczos method. That is, one create an approximation of the whole Hilbert space by creating a so-called Krylov space, which is whose eigenvectors originate from applying powers of H on the initial wave function. So with m being the number of times we apply that, we have an approximation for the Hamiltonian. This part is tridiagonal, and then we can have an approximant for the evolution. The interesting thing is that these people who are coming from are numerical mathematicians, they could show that there is an exact bound to the error you make in this evolution. And let's say if W is the bandwidth of the whole spectrum of the Hamiltonian, so one should take always W times delta t much smaller than 1 in order to have a controlled procedure. But then you see that the convergence with m, let's say we take m equal 10, is very, very good. So in this system, we can deal now with Hamiltonians which are not restricted to have just nearest neighbor interactions.
M is the dimension of the...
M is the dimension of the Krylov space, right.
L sub M?
Well, you know, you can then rewrite the Hamiltonian in a matrices which were this part is a tri-diagonal matrix. Okay.
This is going to be then restricted to a smaller system than your, right? Because you have to end up doing the Lanczos.
We are not doing only Lanczos, so we treat in the MRG the powers of H. Okay, so we will go to large systems, but treating in the MRG the powers of H. Okay, so, since I'm going to show some results with Marcos, with hardcore bosons, I just go fast through this. There is a Jordan-Wigner transformation, of course, and if you have only nearest neighbors or local interactions, this is going to end up in a Hamiltonian for fermions, which has nearest neighbor or local interactions, but it's free. So one can do calculations. The problem is when one is looking at off-diagonal terms, like the Green's function, for example, if you look for the momentum distribution function, but then there is a nice trick from which we use always in a determinant like quantum Monte Carlo. There we are always dealing with a Slater determinant, and which is written here would be the ground state of the fermionic system equivalent to this one. But then these strings are just bilinear forms of fermionic operators, and this applying on a Slater determinant gives again a Slater determinant. So using this trick we can effectively calculate these kind of off diagonal terms. Okay, and now let me come to the results. So, for quantum quenches, I will concentrate here on fermions. These are spinless fermions, one dimension with a repulsive interaction. So, if I forget about this term first, then this system in its ground state has two phases. For V, a repulsive smaller than 2t, it is a metal, an gel liquid. For V larger than 2t is an insulator. V equal to t is the quantum critical point, which in the bosonic language, I mean, if you make a Jordan-Wigner transformation of this, you will have essentially the XZ models. And V equal to t is the XXX point, so the Heisenberg point. Now, for us, it will be interesting at some point to consider also next nearest neighbor terms, because that will make the system non-integrable, and we would like to see if there is some difference between being integrable and non-integrable in this system. And let me come to the first point, which is collapse and revival. How does collapse and revival look in the case of a fermion? Well, we start here with a laryngeal liquid, so we are in some region with V smaller than P, and this is the momentum distribution function showing an edge, which would be the Fermi edge of a laryngeal liquid. Then at time equals 0, we switch on a potential, which is rather large. In this case, V is equal to 10T, so deep in the insulating phase. And what happens as a function of time, you see that we are destroying coherence, we are destroying the Fermi edge. Even we have at some point something like a population inversion. But then as time progresses, so this is cyan color now here, so after this happens, then the yellow happens, and then finally the black one comes exactly back to the momentum distribution we had before. So this is in the atomic limit, so V is very strong. And in fact, if we analyze the frequencies are here, one can show that analytically there are going to be two frequencies, but the strongest frequency, this is an, a logarithmic scale, is V equal 10. Okay, so the period is really 1 over V, which is essentially that the idea that was also happening in the Haber model. This is the atomic limit, but we put a V which is very strong, V equal 10, yes.
But what was T? T is 0.
T is put to 0, yeah, that's the atomic limit, right.
Yeah, but that's not energy liquid.
Initially, yes, because that was initial state. And although there is now no interaction between the sides, you can come back to the initial state. You quench from the kernel, yeah, that's the point.
Sorry, does it quench from 0 to 10?
I think now it was 0.5 or so, but I have to look at it again. It wouldn't make too much of a difference. Of course, at zero you would have a real solid step here, so that's not.
Yeah. Tau is time in units of.
Tau is time in units of 1 over t. This is just momentum. I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay, now I will address the other question is what happens if we wait long enough to see where the system relaxes to? And one thing we will focus on here is the possibility of having different initial states and seeing what happens as the system relaxes. So we will make a, first of all, an evolution with a V which is directly on the critical point. But we will take two states, two initial states, one which is on the laryngeal liquid side, and another one which is on the insulating side. Now, what they have in common is that they have exactly the same energy. Of course, you have a variational principle. If you are here at V equal 2, you can choose always two states which have the same energy. And but this is the minimal requirement we have here. And if we look now at the evolution, so here is for one particular k point, the evolution in time. And when we see these kind of wiggles, which are small around some value, we think, okay, there we can, the system relax. And there we can look at how is the momentum distribution function. And you see that both momentum distribution, both functions, they fall on top of each other. So either you are starting with a metal or you are starting with an insulator. However, the system loses memory of that initial state.
That works also for the correlation functions?
We are looking at a few point correlation functions. Then the density-density correlation function we will did not analyze that precisely, because as the idea is that as you increase the number of points, so to say, of your correlation function, you would expect some point you should be able to recover the full information, right? But in the momentum distribution function, there is no signal of the initial state where that you have. Right, I mean, the insulator will be a very flat function, the laryngeal liquid will be a very steep function, but they both converge to this thing, which is actually steeper than the blue line, and the blue line is what is obtained from quantum Monte Carlo simulation of the same model. So for a temperature where we have the same expectation value of the energy. Okay, so that we would expect to have a, if the thing thermalizes, we would expect the two curves to be on top of each other. They are not, and this is beyond the errors of the simulation.
The curves are at what time? Because these curves,
We are between 10 and 20. One thing is, of course, one could say, well, look, you are in a microcanonical ensemble. You are comparing things with a canonical ensemble. And then there is a question whether things should be equal or not. We are with a finite system, so in principle they are not. So in this small inset, we cannot do a very extremely very careful study of this, but at least we tested the system in two system sizes with 50 sites and 100 sites. Okay, and if the issue of being canonical or microcanonical is there, then we should see that curves go together. That's not what happens. What happens is both set of curves, the quantum Monte Carlo and the density matrix normalization group, they shift, so the separation is still there. So we cannot, from these curves, we think that there is no thermalization. In fact, if one goes to a further separation of states, so let's say now we put our Hamiltonian somewhere where we have a an insulator, but now you see the values we have to use in order to have the same energy are huge, so very far away, then there is no indication of losing memory at all. So in some sense, there is a notion of being close to each other and then one loses memory, or being far away from each other and not losing memory. And I would like to try to give an argument why if we can understand that. Okay, so the main point here is there are situations where the memory of initial state is lost. However, we do not see thermalization.
Alejandro, one question there is, but that's only close to the Fermi surface. I mean, away is a perfect agreement, right?
Away is very good, yeah.
And
yeah, yeah.
Close to the Fermi surface
is where you.
Say that the quasi particles, they will take longer. And
that could be. That could
be an issue too.
Time is always an issue here, yes, that's true. But as far as we could go, we could not see it.
Can you say something about how late in time you can go before you're...
Up to 20, essentially.
But as far as the method is concerned,
right.
I mean, so how do you determine how late you can run your TDMRG?
Oh, okay. We are then what we are well in DMRG. What you have is a the number of states you take from diagonalizing the density matrix, and then you discard all the other states. So there is a weight associated with that, which is called the discarded weight. And so what we fix is the discarded weight, and we see how many states we need in order to accomplish that. And of course, that quantity is increasing as times go by. When and then there is a limit. And when we reach that limit, that's the limit of our method. Okay, and then now the role of integrability. So in this case, we would like to see whether the fact that we did not thermalize is a question of being integral. And here what we do is we switch on the next to next nearest neighbor interaction, so the system is non-integrable. And how far non-integrable is maybe a question. Still here, we still see the same effect. That is, we lose memory of the initial state. These are the two situations where we start on. However, we do not yet thermalize. And well, there is by Marcos a work that appear also where the question is raised about how one would reach thermalization for finite systems, at least in one dimension, where it could be that there is, at least in the numerical results, seems that there is a continuous approach in, to thermalization. I mean, if I interpret your results correctly, okay? Okay, and okay, again with Marcos, with Maximo Shani, they had a very nice idea, which is, well, if you have an integrable system, still one could have a statistical description for the system that one reaches, and which is by looking not only at the von Neumann entropy, but also including all the constraints that appear due to the conserved quantities. And just by applying Jane's principle of maximum entropy, one obtains then a density matrix for the system, which would give the statistical description. And now the question is, how would that work in our system? Actually, that's a very difficult task, because we should ask which are the conserved quantities in our system. And these conserved quantities in our system are not easy to reach. So I will take a much more naive approach, which is, okay, of course, all the powers of H are conserved, because they commute with H. And sure.
I mean, the conserved quantities are known exactly, because it's...
I know, yeah. I know, but it's very demanding to calculate them, right?
Numerically,
yes, because there are strings of right. So we would never be able to, in a fairly large system, to take into account all of them, right? So I will take this approach here to and this will help me at least to understand a little bit what I was saying about being far away or close to each other. Yes. Sure.
Because normally. This thing is well justified only for relative concepts of motion, because the whole business of adding these terms is statistical independence.
That's true. And you're telling me these are not they are not independent.
Yeah, once you do a power, it's not additive any longer. And
that's true.
This procedure makes no sense to me.
Oh, well, these are soundly conserved quantities. And we could ask ourselves, if we include these conserved quantities, if we would have a better description of the system.
You mean it's something absolutely heuristic?
It's heuristic in that sense, and
because
I will show...
On the previous slide, it was well justified for my class.
I understand. But I will show that that heuristic way of considering the system will really improve the description of the system. Okay. Of course, if I consider these as the conserved quantities, then I could obtain a density matrix which is like that. But now I will concentrate in a quantity which, in order to be able to describe what something that has to do with the initial state, so the state on which I do the quench, and the system itself. So define this energy distribution function, given a state on which we apply the Hamiltonian, and taking the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, this gives an energy distribution for that state. Okay. We could, given a density matrix, we can also define an energy distribution. And now we can ask, given a state, we have this function, how well we can approximate this function by this here. And this, I'm sorry, which is it's a little bit small here and a little bit low. So what I'm showing here is the exact quantity here, which is the red line. And now I would like to look at the density matrix by increasing the powers of n. Of course, we cannot go very fast, but one can easily see that the first power is the dashed line, which is going here. The second power is the blue line, which is improving a little bit. The third power are the squares, which are very much improved, and so on. So we expect this to be a measure of how well we can really approach the system. Okay, although, as you tell me, these are not quantities which are independent of each other.
Can it be that you just add sort of more variational parameters? Because what do you do with lambdas? You just adjust them, or what?
We try to maximize the entropy with that, right? That's the only principle we use. We are not adjusting to the given curve. It's not a fitting parameter. Okay, and with the help of this quantity, I mean that we can understand also what is the distance between states. So let me define all these moments for the distance between distribution. And if we remember that we are dealing with a system of nullities, we have a bounded spectrum with a bandwidth W. So I will give an estimate of this distance, which is essentially the zeroth moment divided by the bandwidth. And now I would like, how important are the relative difference of the moments of H? And in fact, one can do this estimate, so this is a bound to this number here. And this bound, you see that if n is an exponentially large number, is telling that these differences are completely relevant. Yes?
So do I understand correctly that if you would know exactly the energy distribution, then you would be able to predict exactly the dynamics? So what you're doing is you're specifying a few cumulants of this distribution and just trying to guess it from the inversion of the cumulant expansion.
Well, we are really not focusing on all observables, right? I mean, what we were doing was a little bit less than that, right? Much less. We were saying we know which is the distribution, and if we include these powers of H, would be closer to that distribution or not? And in fact, the numerics seems to show that it's true. And this exponent here, I'm including 1, 2, 3, and then I have to calculate which are the Lagrange multipliers. Sorry? Yeah, it's a horrible thing. Yes. Well, but this is not in 100 site systems. It's in 18 site systems with exact normalization. We have a control.
That was my question. Exactly my question. Because there is no reason, at least I didn't see one. Why?
So in some sense, it's better to do the Kumo run. It's a strange way to do the. Even the Kumo runs, you can reconstruct the POA.
That's true. Well, I wanted to see whether we can because here is the idea that we will have a distribution description which is statistical. So, which is the density matrix which is describing the state where I'm going? You know, if you calculate the cumulants, you still have to know which are the.
The density matrix in this way is always commute with everything itself, so it's something.
The density matrix in the equilibrium or whatever steady state is supposed to commute with the Hamiltonian by definition, because
right.
It's not supposed to evolve. And this is a kind of a guess of how this constant of motion should look like in terms of the Hamiltonian. Yes.
After you reach some quasi-stationary state, not in the evolution, of course.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, and then what we see is that the sense of being two states being close would be that this distance, if this distance is small enough, then we would have essentially all the other powers are going to be irrelevant. And if this is large, then we will need more and more powers of H. And that's what essentially leads us to an understanding of why, in some cases, we can say the states are close enough to forget the initial state and why they are not close enough to do that. Okay.
Can you also see that in a macroscopic limit, all those higher powers will disappear? Just some microscopic letter showing that when you go to the...
Well, you see, if I use here an exponentially large number,
N is just the power of the Hamiltonian.
Yeah, but in order to reconstruct the full state, I need an exponentially large number, essentially the dimension of the Hilbert space. So those are going to be essentially irrelevant. Okay.
We know from the statistics.
Yeah.
If my our system is microscopically large in terms of its linear size,
okay,
whatever size, then we don't need even N equals 2.
Oh.
Because otherwise we would say that somehow Gibbs distribution does work at all without integrability or anything.
Without integrability, that's true.
Would be absolutely odd. Somehow we want to recover.
That's true.
Basically, what you are saying that you discovered something which works for an isolated mesoscopic system. But for a macroscopic
system,
it's supposed to be a heat bath for itself, right?
Sure. In an integrable system, you should have still not
really
right.
What you say completely. I mean, you start out the system in a pure state, and it remains in a pure state at all times.
Right, but for all practical purposes, it doesn't really matter in many cases. It's like...
We should talk about this afterwards.
Probably, but my question is milder.
Okay.
I care about Gibbs distribution.
Okay.
So can you just show that, say, your delta naught goes to zero when the system size goes to infinity?
No, certainly not.
So then you will be.
How do I? I need the whole spectrum, and the whole spectrum will be dense with a lot of states. How could I show that?
You cannot use a simple Gibbs ensemble unit as a system, because you have constant of Malthus. We have to generalize it, even in the infinite system.
Suppose I just the only additive constant of motion is H. That's basically the basics of Stat-Mech. And we have large enough system with H being the only additive constant. Then we would say, okay, the system would relax. And we can ask Marcus, right? I'm not kidding. The system is supposed generically to relax to something. For all practical purposes, will look like Gibbs distribution. Right?
Right.
and somehow there is a contradiction.
Why?
Because you
I mean, we are speaking about the Gibbs distribution, the traditional one or extended or which one?
My point is your extended Gibbs distribution generally should recover the standard Gibbs distribution, meaning that only n equals 1 is important.
For a system which is non-integrable.
A non-integrable system, but if you have non-integrable system, the powers h of the n are non-trivial in a sense.
Of course, but that's
not
integrable. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, what? Okay. But you see, this argument does not depend on integrability or non-integrability.
Right.
And we have these two different situations where we relax to something, where we lose memory of initial state, however, it's still not thermal. One was non-integral, one is integrable. And I want to understand both situations. And this argument here does not use integrability at all.
Yes.
Okay, that's what I'm
saying. Let me just recall it. Suppose your system is non-integrable.
Okay.
Do you agree with me that for non-integrable system?
I agree, but with this argument, I cannot show.
So if that's the question. The confusion here is that there is no analysis of the observables, what they are doing. Right.
Right.
And we know that ultimately the thermalization is going to come because the observables, they really don't care about that distribution given by the initial state, right? When you are in a non-integral system, because they don't depend on the energy much. So you see that distribution that Alejandro is plotting there, that we know from general grounds that it's going to go
to
zero. The width is going to go to zero. So the shape is going to depend on the initial state, right? But the width is going to go to zero. And then if you are non-integrable, right, what will happen is that the eigenstate, the observable, is going to be very similar. So it doesn't matter which distribution you have, then you will get the same result. So that's
Marcus, for a global quench in the thermodynamic limit.
Yeah, for a large system.
For a large system. Well, we are, well. Yeah.
That's what he's asking. How do you match that with the thermodynamic limit? That's what I
Yeah, the analysis here is for a finite system. And there we still have to figure out how, as you go to the thermodynamic limit, things will change. I mean, I'm trying to understand now the results we were having on these finite systems, and I say, well, this argument does not depend on integrability, but I see that there is a notion of states being close or far away from each other, which will let me understand that we forget the initial conditions. In fact, we were not seeing integrability, thermalization. Thermalization would be that only n equal 1 would be important here, right? Okay, let me come now to the evolution of correlation. So now we follow, we do not wait until things come to some quasi-stationary state, but we look now at what happens as time goes by. And we will consider here the density-density correlation function. And starting, let's say, our initial state correspond to an insulator, and then we make a quench to a non-interacting system, a system on the critical point. An insulator with a V which is smaller than the initial one, an insulator with V which is larger than the initial one. And let's say green is zero, and then we have values which are positive or negative, and essentially you see that information through the system is going ballistically, and that doesn't matter in which situation we are. Essentially, what we observe is something that was predicted by Calabrese and Cardi for a specific situation, namely when one starts with a system with a gap, a massive system, a massive state. So this will be this V equals 10. And then the quench is made to a conformal field theory, which would be this case here. And the idea is that, paths which are close to each other, which are entangled with each other, then they will have, in the conformal field theory, a ballistic propagation of information. And so if you wait a time t, the distance over which things are entangled will correspond to this quantity 2, because one is going one direction, the other direction. However, we can see that this here is also in the insulating case. And it's interesting to see how the information is propagating when one is looking, in fact, at the insulator. And so I show here how the correlation functions look like as a function of distance for different times. For these two cases of a quench with 5 and 20, and what you see is that essentially the amplitude of the correlation function begins to increase and goes through the system. Now, this is a very strange thing because at the beginning, you see that the correlation length is essentially like one side. And this is shown here at t equals 0. We have a semi-log plot here, and this is decaying in one decade in essentially one side. But now we can look at the correlation correlation function in this semi-log plot as time passes by, and we see that the slope, which is essentially the correlation length, is becoming smaller and smaller, which means that the correlation length is getting larger and larger, and in that way is how information goes through the system by increasing its correlation through the system. Well, we have the other situation where we can make a quench from a laryngeal liquid to an insulator. In this case, we are going from a system which has no broken symmetry to a system which in its ground state would have a broken symmetry. And then, I don't know if you see it, I think here is very difficult to see, but here you see it better. This is something which is coming more green here, and here is coming more yellow, and here going more yellow, and here more green, and again inverted here. So there is a phase slip occurring in the correlation function. And if you look at the density profile, since we have open boundary conditions, we can see how the pattern of the charge density wave appears. But there are distinctly here, this is at time t equal 5, how domain walls appear in the system. In a way, this is the remnants of different sectors which are increasing in time. If you want, this is would be a kind of a baby version of Kibble-Zurek mechanism after a quench. Yes, but the Friedel oscillations are without any kink.
Where's the kink?
Oh, here. You see, up, down, up, down, down, down. Yeah, sure.
Kibble-Zurek, actually, I'm interested in sort of reverted anti-Kibble-Zurek. So
okay.
Start with the state with long range order.
Mm-hmm.
The general algebraic doesn't matter.
Okay.
Then you quench to the state when in equilibrium,
right,
the range order should be absent. But suppose you're not far from, say, critical point, so that it's
okay.
Sort of slow process.
So you want to have this situation.
Yeah, but I'm interested in sort of slow, because you see, the long range order would is supposed to be destroyed by some defects.
Okay.
And I presume that the process would be rather slow. Because
well,
once the long range order is there, it's not, in my opinion, easy to destroy it if you are not far enough from the critical point. Correct.
Well, let me see. This is the critical point, and we are jumping from the insulator. And what we see here is essentially the phases are pretty much preserved.
But my idea is to jump from the state with long range order. Like
yeah, which is this one.
But you are saying insulator. There is no long range order if it's an insulator.
A long range, this is a charge density wave,
oh,
right?
The charge density.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Ah,
yeah, it's a broken symmetry state.
Definitely.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
So there is nothing like the anti.
So you mean that you immediately destroy everything?
No, we preserve the order. Look, red, blue, red, blue, red, blue, and then this decays, of course. But you see, the order is expanding. If you want,
the order is expanding.
As a function of time, I have more sides which are in the order phase.
Your system is not homogeneous.
No. You see the how the correlation looks like.
I would be interested in a homogeneous system.
Yeah, I understand, but I'm showing the situation you were asking for. Okay. 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 Well, let me come to the free expansions in a lattice, and which are interesting features due to a lattice. So let me go to some old work. done by Marcos. Here is hardcore bosons in a lattice with 1,000 sites. There's 300 hardcore bosons, and they're starting from a fog state, so n equal 1, and then one looks at how it evolves. And then the interesting thing is that there is a peak, so it's a Bose-Einstein condensation, but at this wave vector. The wave vector is determined by the lattice. So one can, the fact of having a lattice is that one can determine which is the momentum that cloud will have. And one can also find that this is also the case for U finite. And Marcos did a proposal recently what happens for the three-dimensional case. Maybe I just skip that due to time. Let me come to what happens now. We look at expansions in strongly repulsive fermions. So I will concentrate here on the Haber model on a one-dimensional lattice. And in order to have time enough to make the expansion, we will put the system with all the fermions on one side, and then we'll look at what happens in the expansion. Right. So there are two situations. One with the initial state is a Mott insulator, so density is equal to 1, and then 0. And then the other situation where the initial density is smaller than 1, so we have a Lorentzian liquid, but in a small part of region of space. And now we let it expand. And when it expands, what happens is very similar to what happened also with the hardcore bosons, although, of course, since there are fermions, we cannot have all of them here, but the peak is around pi half. And this is the initial momentum distribution function corresponding to this Mott insulator. And then these are, as a function of time, there is a momentum because there is a cloud which is moving in one specific direction. But you see that essentially after time passes by, then one reaches essentially the same wave vector one had in the Bose-Einstein condensate. Here, when we have a density which is smaller than 1, then we have this is the initial momentum distribution function. And then, as we see the momentum distribution function of time, we see that there is an edge forming in here. So you would expect that there is something like a Fermi edge forming. And if you compare this with the momentum distribution function of what we call a reference system, which is this here, and I'm explaining right away what is that, you see this line is pretty much parallel to this one. In fact, this is actually, these simulations were done by Fabian Heidrich Meissner, who was here until today, I think, in the morning. And so now let me explain what the reference system is. I'm sorry. The reference system is, we call a reference system a system which has the same instantaneous density distribution as the evolving system. And with that density, one can calculate different physical quantities. And so, for example, the momentum distribution function, as I told you before, or the structural factors for spin and density. So here are the four spin and density for both situations, starting from a Mott insulator or starting from a Lorentzian liquid, and here is density. And the dashed line is the initial form of the structure factor, which you know it should be because of it's a Lorentzian liquid with a 2kF singularity for the spin. But then we see the black lines are at different times, which are written down here. And the dots are calculated in the ground state of that reference system. So for each time we have the instantaneous distribution of density, and there if you calculate the structure factors, you'll see that they match on top of each other. So the interesting thing is that there is a ground state which can describe the correlations out of equilibrium of a moving state. Yeah.
This is data from the part of the system which remains in the initial.
No, this is the full system. For what you are asking, I think is the second thing, which is what we call a quantum distillation. Is how a system could reach in some part of it a state which has a low entropy. And so what one has here is just the Haber model. Let's take a Haber model at very large U. We have a large system, but we put on 10 sites 18 particles as initial state. And on doing that, what happens is, of course, you release the system, the particles should go away. But as time passes by, you see that the density in the first, in the initial sites, it's increasing. So particles are going away, but at the edge of the system, the intensity is going up. And in fact, if you look at what happens with the number of particles, you see that they reach the limit in the first sites of two particles. So essentially, one is having a Fock state with two fermions per site. No. Here is the fluctuations as time passes by, fluctuations are suppressed, and here you have double occupancy. One reaches double occupancy, fully double occupancy in that site. So what is happening here is these particles are going away, but then we are forming a state in that region with two particles per site, so there is no possibility for that state to do anything else, right? So it's like a part is freezing into a Fock state, and that's what we call in this distillation, because we are evaporating, so to say, the high entropy part, and we are remaining with a very low entropy part. Although it's not going to be the thermodynamic entropy, here this curve is showing what happens with entanglement entropy. So, of course, if one has a Fock state, it should be completely decoupled from the rest. And what is seen here is, for the situation I've shown before, what happens as time passes by with the entanglement entropy for different portions of the system. And what one sees is that there is a strong decrease of that entanglement entropy, meaning that that part of the system is getting decoupled from the other one. And of course, if ideally one would have a Fock state, that would be a zero entropy state. Okay, so. Let me make a summary of what I was telling here. The point for a quantum quench is that there is the initial state memory can be lost. We could not see thermalization. And then for the propagation of information, we have this line called light cone picture also in the gap phase. And also, we could just see this Kibble-Zurich mechanism in a very easy settlement. And in the free expansions, one can see that the condensate can be produced at a very well-defined Feynman momentum, which is given by the underlying lattice. And also fermions tend to then, if one starts, so that will be a signal of starting with a Mott insulator, that one sees that the momentum distribution is peaked at pi over 2 divided by A, where A is the lattice constant of the lattice on which the evolution is taking place. And although one is out of equilibrium, there are equilibrium systems which can give an accurate description of correlations in that situation. And one way of getting into a low entropy state would be just to evaporate in a high density Haber model with n for fermions with n close to 2, then we expect that at the end will be a portion of the system where essentially n equal 2 is reached. Okay, and have to thank the collaborators in these several works. Some of you know them, Elvio Dagotto, Adrian Feghin in Wyoming, Fabian Heidrich Massner, who was here, Salvatore Manmana, who's now at GILA with Anna Maria, and then Reinhard Noack, Marcus Rigol, whom you know, and Stefan Bessler, who you know also was here. Okay, and thank you for your attention.
States that you get?
Well, that depends on how many particles you have at the beginning. We are not having too many particles, because that would mean that we need a very, very long system, right? So in this case, you see up to 5. We started with 10 particles, with 10 sites, and up to site equal 5, we reach essentially double occupancy, full double occupancy. X equal 10, of course, not. But essentially half of the system. Yeah.
So the peak at 5 half is, so what about if you have longer range interactions. They modify the peak in the.
I don't. We did not do that. But a little bit, I think, I don't know if that's going to be a very incident with interaction. I think Marcos had a nice argument, is that essentially we are starting from a system where it has a very a flat momentum distribution function, because we are starting from a multi-insulator, right? So a momentum distribution function is flat. And now we have essentially states which should be particle hole symmetric. Right, they are, I don't know how the bands are, but it should be particle hole symmetric. And so now there will be an exchange of momentum between different states. And the symmetric point is in the middle. And if you would have something like a band, you would catch up pi over two.
I have a question about this light cone effect. So if you consider the integrable model, so that this speed should be more or less the maximum speed of your quasiparticles.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I suppose that you'd now break integrability by your second nearest neighbor interaction.
Okay.
So how will the speed depend on this breaking? I mean, what is the relevance?
Well, we did not investigate that correctly, but I would expect that if you are in a laryngeal liquid phase, although you broke integrability, right? You would have essentially the velocity of, let me try to show another data, piece of data. Okay, this is the speed of propagation of information I was showing you. And so here is a V equal 2. And in this range, up to V equal 2, we have the velocity of the excitations directed from Betti ansatz. Mm-hmm. And we can compare with this is it's not, yeah, that's a XXZ, right? Okay. Well, the velocity of propagation is essentially given by that velocity of excitations. However, when we go deep into the insulator, we have something which we do not know what to assign to, because that velocity is not changing anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So here, of course, we are not having something like a well-defined linear dispersion or something like that. But I would think that the fact that one has, in this region where one has a laryngeal liquid, even if we put V prime, should be just the velocity of the charge excitations, which is being there, right?
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
So I had a general question to all the experts, actually. The question of this collapse and revival. So now I apologize, I indeed the paper is without the
screen. Okay, good.
It was the other paper, I just came here. And the question is like that in the very relatively simple situation that occurs in this experiment for the bosons, it is relatively easy to predict what is the time of collapse and what is the time of revival. The time of revival is 1/U,
right,
because this is the smallest level spacing, and it's actually exact in the simple model, it's exact smallest level spacing in the model. And the time of collapse is related to the width of your initial wave packet. So if you have, let's say, m atoms on the side, the fluctuations are around the square root of m, and time of collapse is then 1/U square root m, okay, so this width. But my question is, and this works perfectly, okay? My question is, how does it all carry to the general situation of many body systems? Is there somehow good theory of general collapse and revival, which would have to involve not only density of states and the width of the initial states, but also the level spacing statistics?
What's the statement of the problem? Do you switch
the question
off
is
completely?
Is there a kind of general theory for many body systems of a problem which is called collapse and revival?
Depending on one little detail, whether you switch off hopping completely or not. If you switch it off completely, then the
No. I'm not talking about complete model of Bloch. I'm talking about the n Hamiltonian. I prepare a state which is a wave packet, let's say in energy states. And I'm asking, will it revive? After which time? Will it collapse? After which time?
No,
this is my question.
Level spacing is going to determine.
This is what I'm saying, but is there some general theory of that done? because if not, let's go and do it.
Well, that's
the next week.
I don't know. I mean, for example, in mesoscopics, that's called the Heisenberg revival time.
This is the Heisenberg, yes.
Yeah, the Heisenberg time.
Because it's a
point. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if
you have in general, but this context, is the general experience. In this context, for instance, what I see is if I have an integral system which has a lot of very small spacings, and if I prepare my initial state with many subspaces corresponding to different different constants of motion, then probably I will not have revival at all. Sure. So it will mix up, you see?
Yeah.
So even though
you always have revival, if you wait long enough, you always will have revival.
You always
have revival. Yeah, but the time will be
I would say that revival itself is a sort of pathological property of a system. So a system should be somehow pathological, otherwise I wouldn't expect any revival at all. In this case, we understand what's pathological about the system. It's essentially 1 to 3 frequencies. Otherwise,
sense, you may say revival is pathological, but it's a generic thing for discrete space. It's generic for any system that has discrete spectrum.
Absolutely, but in this, having a discrete, essentially discrete spectrum of relevant frequencies in a macroscopic system is pathological.
I don't know.
Can I ask another question?
Sure.
Which would be your reference system that you were using to calculate the structure factor? Can you repeat how that
works? This is the system with the instantaneous density profile, which means you.
What's the Hamiltonian?
The Haber Hamiltonian, the same Hamiltonian.
With some local chemical potential.
Yeah, you have to fix the
chemical potential.
Oh, yeah, if not, okay. Yeah. So it essentially is like saying it's a kind of a local density theory, if you want, what is acting here. But in a time-dependent local density theory, the functional is a functional of the density, which is a function of x and t. What we are saying is it's local in t.
Have you looked in this speed of propagation, if this path, which you cannot associate to any sound, as you say, because it's bounded by this little Robinson bound, which exactly is for this kind of thing.
There should be a bound here, looks like, but how do we choose that velocity? Because we have, essentially, we'll have a gap system here. Here we are inside here. The Hamiltonian has a gap spectrum. And the thing is, we are spreading this initial state. We'll have overlap with many of those states, right? So which is the part of the spectrum we are picking up? So if you know, essentially, which is the part of the spectrum, you could essentially make an assignment of say, OK, velocity would be that here. But here it's not clear. And in fact, it's pretty insensitive to the gaps we are opening. So I don't know. Yes.
When you say Kibler-Zurek scaling, so have you compared your data systematically with the prediction of that?
Okay, baby. I should make the emphasis on baby Kibler-Zurek, which means, in Kibler-Zurek, what you have is a quench which has some time dependence, right? Let's say the easiest thing is to make it linear. And here we have something which is just very fast, infinitely fast. So there is no scaling which we can associate here to the time by which the scale, the quench is made.
So the only connection is the appearance
of defects.
That's why I would prefer to separate Kibler-Zurek mechanism from Kibler-Zurek type.
That's true.
The mechanism is all about slowly cooling or whatever.
Well, cooling.
Because it's all about competition of critical
of regions,
slowing down
okay.
And the rate of slow cooling. Otherwise,
okay.
There is no theory.
But still, the picture that you have different regions which are increasing with different, which is essentially phases,
picture,
right?
Kibler-Zurek mechanism.
Right. Okay. Which with different phases.
Absolutely.
That's the idea.
Picture is there.
Right. Right.
Okay. So let's stop here and sing a little again.
Yeah.